Good evening, I'm Allie Lightfoot. Welcome to the North Fork Storytellers. This is a collaboration between KVNF and the Blue Sage Center for the Arts in Paonia. This series brings together talented people from around the North Fork Valley to tell true stories on a common theme. For our spring edition of the show, we chose the theme, The Birds and the Bees. High Country News Managing Editor and KVNF Board Member Brian Calvert and I produced this series. Brian is the MC at the events and will be introducing our speakers. Part one of The Birds and the Bees will be featuring storytellers Steve Cassard, Dana Stovern, Dakin Henderson, and Diane Sylvain.
The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns, folks in Siam do it, think of Siamese twins, some Argentine.
Our first storyteller is going to be Steve Cassard. He's a small farm homesteader. He lives outside of Paonia. Steve, come on up, and let's give a round of applause for Steve Cassard.
Nice, a chair.
3 years ago, I decided to start beekeeping again after many years. And so I secured my bees from a local beekeeper. The day came when I was to pick my bees up. I left early in the morning for Cedar Edge to meet with the beekeeper at his bee lot. And I prepared myself, I had water bottle, I cleaned out my Jeep Wrangler. I was ready to pick up the bees and make an easy transition back home. It was April, it was cool, which is when you want to move bees. Bees don't like it when you move them in the heat of the day. They're very, very active. So I got down to Chris's, picked up the bees, paid him, spent more time than I should had talking about bees, and then head out toward back home to Paonia. Bees are transported in little tight cardboard boxes. The whole apparatus is called a niche. And so I felt secure. The boxes couldn't move. Took off down the road. A mile down the road, I noticed there were some bees in my car. Just a few. So I didn't think anything of it. Turned on to Highway 65, and 3 miles down the road, I was at the intersection of 92, and I noticed that I was getting a furry headliner with bees. So I had 17 miles to go. So I didn't want to open the car and let my precious bees out, so I just took off down the road. So I'm running down the road, 65, 70, 75 miles an hour. There's more bees. Pretty soon my shifter looks like a bee meatball. And I'm feeling a load on my shoulders. And there's dozens of bees flying around in the car. 15 miles to go. I'm going 80. And then I realized that that's not a smart thing to do, because bees emit pheromones, and that's how they communicate with each other. And they can say, you know, sit down, enjoy the ride, or attack. So I slowed down to 65. I figured that if they started attacking, I could safely jump out of the car at that speed. At about mile marker 12, my hat is leaning over and bees are pouring off of my head like molasses. So I said, well, you know, I need to come up with a plan. So the first thing I thought about was, I'll just take out my electric toothbrush. It sounds like a bee. So I started digging around on the floorboard of my car for my toothbrush. I mean, that's where y'all keep your toothbrush, right? And then I realized that maybe this would be the wrong signal. Maybe it would be the wrong message to the bees. So I'm down to about mile marker 9, and I think, well, okay, smoke calms bees. So I start digging around in my console for a couple of joints. And then I remembered, the story that was in the Delta Independent about the school teacher that had a joint before going to school one day and killed all her students. So I thought, oh, no. I don't want these bees to get high and attack me. So I'm doing, at mile marker 5, I'm doing 45 miles an hour and wondering what in the world am I going to do. And then I noticed this bee had been buzzing right in front of me for the last 3 or 4 miles. And suddenly it dawned on me that this bee was just as confused about what was happening as I was. At that point, everything clicked. I realized it was just the rest of the trip was going to be a joyride. So that's my story about me and the bees and the joyride.
All right, thanks. I want to welcome our next speaker. Her name is Dana Stovern. She moved to Paonia 3 years ago with 6 hives of bees from Durango over Red Mountain Pass. Dana, come on up.
Evening light. All right, deep breath. So my story is about the synchronicity of bees. And the first synchronicity of bees in my life happened one summer day when my friend Carol in Durango called me up, and without even saying who she was or even saying hello, she said, "You're a beekeeper, aren't you? You want bees. You want beehives. My friend Farron, he's selling beehives. He was a beekeeper. Do you want to buy them?" I'm like, Carol? I believe I do. I believe I want to be a beekeeper. And that was the first synchronicity, because the bees knew that I was a beekeeper before I even knew I was a beekeeper. They were calling me in. So within about a week or 10 days, give a few. My husband and I, Bob, and met Carol. We went over to Farron's. We were at a Farron's house. And Farron was a beekeeper of about 30 years. And he physically couldn't keep bees any longer. And it was breaking his heart that he had to give up his bees. But he was very excited that there was somebody who was excited about beekeeping. And with a little nest egg of money, I purchased the whole kit and caboodle. It was like 8 hives and the foundations and the cinder blocks and the honey extractor and the bee suits and the hive tool and the smoker. I mean, it was the whole thing. And so I handed him the cash, and Bob and I loaded it up in the pickup truck, and we drove away. So I had my start as a beekeeper. The next spring, Carol and I, we got a bunch of beekeepers together, and Carol and I drove down to Santa Fe, and we picked up about 25 to 30 bee packages. Now, for those of you that don't know about bees, bee packages is one of the modes that beekeepers get their bees, and it's a box that holds about 3 pounds of bees. It's got a sugar water can and a queen in a little cage, and that's what you call a package of bees. So Carol and I drove all the way to Santa Fe one day, and we drove all the way back with 25 to 30 packages of bees in the back of the truck, buzzing around. We got back, and people came and picked up their bees, and then Bob and I installed those bee packages, into the hives at twilight that evening. It was a spring, blustery evening, and we installed them in, and that was the beginning, the magic of the bees. And the thing you got to know about bees is that it doesn't take too long for them to get in you. Like, they buzz around you, but after a while, you feel that buzzing inside of yourself, and it's pretty addictive. It feels really, really good. So that summer, between YouTube videos and a lot of trial and error, I kind of began to figure out how to be a beekeeper. And that's when the second synchronicity happened, the second synchronicity with the bees, because Bob and I had been trying to get pregnant for over a year. And as I kept those bees and opened the hives up and got my hands down in them and felt those bees around me and me, I felt something shift. I felt something shift in my body. And that September, my birthday month, I got pregnant. And that was the second synchronicity of the bees. And we were really excited about this because I was 40. It was our chance to have a family. And we were pretty amazed because it was a really, really great big miracle. And the pregnancy was healthy. We moved into winter. And you got to know that in the wintertime, bees hibernate. They go into their hive. You got to winterize the hive. And they go into their hive and they clump together and they vibrate and they keep their temperature up and they hibernate. But when you're a beekeeper and it's wintertime, you go stand out at the edge of the hives and you wonder, are my bees alive? Are they still in there? Are they doing their thing? And you begin to get impatient for the spring to come because you miss your bees. And so late winter, early spring, I started standing on the edge of my bee yard, anticipating the bees coming out. There's that sense of like, oh my God, they're going to begin to come out of the hive and I can begin to see them. So I began checking in with them. Late winter, early spring, and my belly is kind of getting big, and bees start coming out, and I'm watching them and enjoying them, and then I begin to think a little bit and go, wait a minute, what am I going to do when I'm 6 months pregnant, and 7 months pregnant, and 8 months pregnant, and 9 months pregnant? I mean, do you want to do beekeeping when you're that pregnant? And so I had this thought going on in my head, thinking, what am I going to do? Do I need help? Do I not do it? Asking these questions. And it didn't take very long for my question to get answered in a way that I didn't anticipate. And it was something very tragic that happened, and also something very miraculous that happened. And that's the next synchronicity of the bees, is because 6 years ago today, we lost our son. I spiked with severe blood pressure with preeclampsia. My husband had to rush me to the hospital. And my blood pressure was 275 over 175. It is amazing. I am here alive tonight telling this story. And Kenyon's heartbeat, his heart wasn't strong enough to hold the beats. And so I died that day and was rebirthed. And my son, he was birthed and he died. The doctors put us into emergency C-section. They delivered him. And he didn't make it. And the synchronicity of this part of the story is, I think it's kind of crazy that how did we end up telling a story about birds and bees on April the 5th? That's the 6 year anniversary of this happening. That's a pretty big synchronicity. So, but that's not the end of the story. It continues. So I was on life support for 36 hours and survived and came back. And Bob delivered me back home safely to our home. And we began our recovery process. A lot of shock, a lot of trauma, a lot of tears, a lot of emptiness, a lot of wondering, you know, how could this happen? And gradually I was able to begin to get up out of bed and move again. And I found myself back at the edge of those hives. I gravitated back to the edge of the bee yard. And the bees were still there doing their thing. And I knew as a beekeeper that spring I was supposed to be doing something, but I didn't know what it was because I was a brand new beekeeper. And I stood at the edge of those hives in numbness and shock and feeling empty and watching the hives and seeing something going on and more activity each day. It kept growing and thinking, God, I really should be doing something, but I can't even function. And then one morning in May, it happened. Bob and I were in the house, and we heard this huge sound. And we ran outside, and the air was just full of bees. It was just massive bees. The air was dark. It was like a locomotive, like a shamanistic buzzing locomotive. And we just stood there in shock, and my reaction was, oh my God, I lost my son. I can't lose my bees too. And I was so fortunate to have someone say to me, Dana, the bees were birthing. The bees were swarming. When there gets to be too many bees in a hive and it's the springtime, hives split. They swarm, and that swarm is a hive giving birth to the sky. And that's what happened. And I didn't lose my bees that day. My bees gave birth that day. And that was really, really important. And that was the next synchronicity of the bees. The bees were birthing when I had such a tragedy happen. And Bob and I stood there, and it was like somebody flipped a switch, and the bees began to fold themselves up like a blanket into this bundle, like a balloon with a little string on the end. And then they began to bob and weave in the air, and they began to leave. And we were on Florida Mesa outside of Durango, south of Durango, and that bundle of bees, that swarm of bees, just bobbed in the air and moved out over the Animas River Valley. It was beautiful. If you've been there, the Animas River Valley is about 800 feet deep, and the La Plata is behind, and there went my bees, and they just went off in the distance until they disappeared. And there's one more synchronicity of the bees, because after that happened, it snapped something awake in me again, that these hives were alive, that the queens were laying eggs, that the brood was developing, that the brood was birthing, and these hives were growing. And I got some help. Some people came out and got extra boxes on them, and then as I got strong enough, on the days when Bob really saw that I was in numbness and shock, he'd bodily pick me up and dress me in my bee suit and gently shove me outdoors. And I would go out, and I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I'd start opening hives and get my hands in them and pull the frames out and do the bee checks, and feeling those bees around me and feeling that buzzing, that warm gold buzzing inside me. And that was the next and last of the synchronicity of the bees with the story, is that they began to fill in me something that no one could or anything could with the loss of my son, where I felt so empty and in so much numbness and so much shock. And those bees helped bring me back to life again. They filled me up. And they brought me back. And that's how I began to learn about the synchronicity of the bees.
Thanks. Thanks, Dana. That story was about more than bees. Now I'm going to bring up Dakin Henderson. Dakin is a filmmaker here in town for Lost Cabin Productions. So let's welcome him up. Dakin.
Thank you, Brian. I used to work on a research crew studying flammulated owls. Flammulated owls are a tiny species of owl. They're about as big as the breadth of my hand. And they have this territorial call, the males. It sounds like, and when they're getting really aggressive and territorial, it's like a double hoot. It's like, ooh, 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 ooh. Flammulated owls are secondary cavity nesters, so they raise their families in abandoned woodpecker holes. And our job in the afternoon was to walk through the forest and search for nests. So we had like a camera on top of a really tall telescoping pole that we would systematically go through and stick the camera into every tree cavity in the forest looking for owl nests. And you have like a screen down here, so you'd be like, oh, hello, pine squirrel. You know, ooh, there's a flicker nest. Most of the cavities were empty, but eventually we would come to one and it was like, hello, Mrs. Flammulated Owl. The real work started when the sun went down. This is one of the cool things about the job, is like, in order to study the owls, we had to become creatures of the night. And once we knew the location of the nest, we'd go back there to capture the owls. So some days it was my job to go back to the nest site, this time with a net on top of that pole. And you raise the net up to just the right height and then sort of balance it hovering in the air a few feet away from the entrance to the nest and wait for the male to come in and start making prey deliveries. And the male would come in and he'd have a moth in his mouth or something like that and perch in one of the trees or branches next to or near the nest. And then there would begin this sort of standoff. Because the male's up there and he's like, I got to feed my kids. But you're down there and there's this thing hovering there and like, I don't know if I want to do that right now. And you got to hold the net really still, because if the male doesn't go in and make that prey delivery, or if he flies away, then you're impacting the nest and the owlets aren't getting the food that they need. And if that goes on for too long, you just got to pack up and leave. And one of the most zen moments I think I've ever had was when a mosquito landed on my arm right in the middle of one of those standoffs. And I just had to let that little bugger suck his fill. So that eventually the male flew in, mustered up the courage, delivered his prey, and I brought the net into the tree and caught him. I've had arguments with people about whether or not humans are still a part of nature. And I love this argument. It's like nature, this interlocking web of complex organisms and interactions and energy and resources, are we still a part of that? I love the argument. I appreciate both sides, but personally, I don't think so. I just think that out here in society, we run on a different set of rules. Something different is going on here. We impact nature for sure, but I don't think we're a part of it anymore. And so when I brought this owl down and untangled him from the net and held him in my hand, I felt how I had reached out and grabbed this wild thing and pulled it out of its world and down into mine. And this owl has no idea why he's here. Like, I know why you're here. You're here because fire suppression, global warming, forest management, logging, like, we want to know if you care about all that stuff. Like, does that matter to you? Does it impact you in any way? And we want to know how. And actually, like, the data that my boss has been collecting over the years, it shows that, yeah, you do care about that stuff. And it does impact you. And I want to tell you that I'm sorry. And I want to do, like, we're going to do what we can to find some sort of middle ground where humans are going to do what we're going to do, but maybe we can do it in a way where, like, you and the rest of you guys can live out your lives more or less naturally. And this owl's just looking up at me like, just eat me, goddammit, and get it over with. But instead, I, you know, put the band on and take my measurements and I let him go. And as soon as he disappears in the darkness, I can't shake this feeling. Like, I just want to follow him out there. I want to follow him into his world and see and feel what it's like. Sometimes birders would come up to the study site because they heard about the research, somehow found out where we were located, and they would want to catch a glimpse of the owls or maybe snap a photo. And whenever we would see unknown headlights coming up the road, everybody would just turn their headlamps off. And it was so easy. Like, you just turn your headlamps off and the car would come up, loop around. Maybe they'd see our car park and get out, like walk around a little bit. And, you know, we were all scattered out in the woods, but with our headlamps off, we could just go about doing what we were doing quietly. And they had no idea that we were there. Or they knew that we were there, but they didn't know where. And they hadn't—they did not know that we were watching them. And maybe these birders from down there on the road would hear coming out of the forest the sound of "Ooh-hoo-hoo." That's flammulated owl for "get out of my house." And whether or not it was coming from one of us or from an actual flammulated owl, they knew what it meant. We did get a little territorial about the study site, I admit it. After living and working up there for a couple of months, we just didn't want other people going onto the study site without our permission. And these feelings sort of went a little too far one night when we discovered that there were people camping on the study site. This is legal. It's public land. But it was our study site. And it was a Friday night, and we finished work about midnight, 12:30 or so, and our boss goes home for the weekend. And we decided that we were going to go back and scare these people. So we get back in the cars, and we drive back to the study site. And I love scaring people. Like, I have 10 other stories that I can tell you about sneaking up on people and scaring them. But never before or since have I been in a situation so perfectly poised to mess with people in the woods at night. Like, we had radios, we had topographic maps and compasses. We didn't even need the maps because we knew every tree in that area. Like, we knew where to park and how to approach so that they would never hear or see us. We were like an elite team of woods pirates. That's what we called ourselves. Woods pirates. And these poor campers they'd pitched their tents in a field kind of at the bottom of a drainage with pretty steep sides. And we spread out. We put two people on either side of the drainage and then one person kind of down drainage. And each of us had a scary noise that we would make. Some of the noises was just like breaking a stick or knocking a branch against a tree or something. But there was one guy who could make a noise that sounded sort of like a cross between an elk bugle and an elephant. I had a scary noise, and I called it the ringwraith scream. Inspired by those creepy half-dead horsemen from Lord of the Rings. It sounds like this. I don't know what it sounds like in this room, but I would like to think that at 2 o'clock in the morning, in a pretty remote area from inside of a tent, that sound like might get your pulse going a little quicker. And then the best sound that we had of all of us was this girl who would say the word daddy. It's like, daddy, she would say it like the way she would form the syllables and project the sound out into the night. It sounded like the ghost of an 8-year-old boy like wandering through this like remote mountain. And like, it gave me chills and I knew where it was coming from. So we were strategic about this. We would take turns making our noises. And the important thing, and we all agreed upon this, was to wait no less than 5 minutes in absolute silence between each noise. Because you know that the scariest part about being afraid is the waiting. It's what your imagination does in the silence and in the unknown. So a light goes on in the tent, and we hear voices. And we hear the tent unzip, and the flashlight emerges, and it starts waving it around into the darkness up where we are. We're a good distance away. And I remember his name. He's like, hey Murph, I thought I heard an elk or a moose or something. And that was when Daddy floats up valley from behind him. And the waving of the flashlight slows and then stops, and then he turns it off. We just basked in his fear. And we dragged this on for a little while, made a few more noises. At some point, I heard a car door open and close. And to this day, I'm so grateful that no shots were fired that night. Because finally, we decided that it was enough, and we all retreated to the top of the ridge. And I had brought like a big hunting flashlight with me. That's big, battery-powered, powerful flashlight. And from the top of the ridge, we flipped it on and illuminated their entire campsite. And you could see, here's this guy in his underpants, like holding his flashlight, and another guy over there by the tents. And they just looked so like vulnerable and awkward and out of place. And we knew that our job was done. Thank you.
This is a copy editor for High Country News. She's an artist. She's lived in town for a while, and she's one of our favorite storytellers here at this event. Welcome, Diane Sylvain.
Years ago, when I lived at about 9,500 feet above sea level in Cripple Creek, Colorado, every spring I would have to flee that wind-blasted, snow-shattered, frozen, plumbing, loud, drunk jukebox of a suddenly too small town for the silence of the canyons and the desert for a long backpacking trip. And then suddenly I couldn't backpack anymore. So now I go to monasteries instead. And yes, as I've said before, Trappist monasteries are a great place to meet guys. But that's not really why I go. I think of it more as backpacking still, but this time into the spiritual wilderness. And I just got back from a week-long retreat at St. Benedict's, which is about 8,000 feet above sea level in a mountain valley north of here. I stayed alone in a little hermitage and cooked my own meals and did a lot of walking. My hermitage was about a mile from the monastery itself, and I went to all the services. And since it was Holy Week, there were a lot of services. I got up at 3 or so to walk down to 4:30 vigils and returned for Mass or Lauds at 7:30, and then came back in the evening for Vespers. I walked, I read, I thought, I prayed, and I listened, and I looked at things. I watched late winter do its complicated tango with early spring, the kind of dance where you're never quite sure who's leading whom. And I watched clouds and birds and other creatures. I don't really know much about birds, but I know what I like. I love the corvids for their intelligence and adaptability and the insouciant way they dance through the air as if flying is just so much fun and you are just such an idiot to be tromping around on the ground. Ravens, of course, know that they run the universe. And there were magpies everywhere, coasting down the sky, flipping their outrageously long tails. Every time I saw a hawk, I'd be moved to bellow out Hopkins' poem, "My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing," which doesn't really impress hawks. And almost every day, I got to see and hear red-winged blackbirds with their curious, oddly lyrical, kind of rusty-hinged gurgle of a warble. And there were bluebirds, looking like nothing so much as pieces of the sky. Every time I saw one, I'd want to look up in the sky as if it was a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, and maybe a little winged piece had come loose and fallen to the ground, as if the sky were a mosaic shedding bits of itself. Everything there seemed to be dancing, especially the bunnies. I can't call them rabbits because they were just too cute. And if you've ever seen them court, you know why they named a very lively dance the bunny hop. They just bounced up and down, impressing each other and me with their fluffy gymnastics, far too busy to pay attention to a mere human. I saw elk, deer, prairie dogs, one sharp-eyed, arrowhead-faced ermine, still mostly white, a very rumpled, sleepy-looking marmot, and there were coyotes, always, yodeling to beat the band. I spent one afternoon watching a couple of little western ground squirrels flirt with each other, like teenagers in high school, sort of elaborately pretending to ignore each other and flexing their muscles and flipping their hair and squirming around until at some signal I couldn't ever figure out, they suddenly gave up and just rushed into each other's paws in the most romantic way possible, like the end of a Hollywood musical. Once I joked with one of the monks about the bunnies. "Don't they know they're living in a celibate community?" I asked. He just laughed. "One Sunday morning," he said, that being the busiest day for the monastery because quite a few folks from the surrounding community come for the Sunday Mass, there were two very large skunks getting it on right in the monastery parking lot. And people were upset, not for moral squeamishness, but because what are you going to do if skunks are doing anything and they're in between you and their cars? There was one lady who said to the abbot, "Don't they know this is a monastery?" The monks thought it was hilarious. The abbot said, "Well, they might be wearing the black and white that the Trappists do, but as far as I know, they never took formal vows. I think we should just bless the union and do our best not to interrupt the honeymoon." Now, when I was younger myself, I used to fill up entire journals with the operatic details of my often silly but always entertaining love affairs. Now I keep the world's most boring journals because all I ever do is write about this kind of thing, weather and sky and clouds. This is also my way of writing about God, more or less. And not much happens, really, but it's enough. I don't mean to put off people by using the word God, but there it is, probably the healthiest and certainly the longest relationship I've ever managed so far. It has its ups and downs, but at least I never have stomped home crying because my boyfriend and I got into a fight at a party somewhere. So anyway, every day it was birds and books and clouds and critters. And every night it was moon and stars and planets, except on the days and nights when it was also blizzarding snow and gale-force winds and hard, bitter sleet, which was also pretty much every day and night, this being Colorado. It's a good thing that I love weather as much as I do, because I often got 10 or 12 different seasons in a single afternoon, as randomly shuffled as a deck of playing cards. But the longer I spent up there, the quieter I got. Every morning before 4, I walked that road down into the valley where the monastery nestles. And sometimes, especially after a snow, It seemed as if I were walking that road directly into the moon, as if I were being tugged into the path of its light by the tidal pull I could feel in my own blood. The week before Easter, Holy Week, commemorates the Last Supper, death, and resurrection of you-know-who. I believe, odd as it might sound, in the Incarnation, the notion that God became completely human in this world in the person of a particular guy at a particular time, who, like the desert monks used to say, pitched his tent among us here. And at this time of year, that story reaches its climax. On Holy Saturday, which is the vigil of the night before Easter Sunday, we Catholics go back to the very beginning, kindling a brand new Easter fire, blessing new holy water, just piling on the smells and the bells and the music and the stories and all that good stuff. But you can't start the Easter vigil unless it's dark enough to see at least one star. You can start later than that, which is why at 4:30 a.m. I found myself in the refectory where the monks eat, sitting in complete silence and darkness for half an hour as other people silently came in and joined me. At exactly 5, a new fire was kindled in the back of the room, and Joe, the abbot, began to speak, walking up and down, his white robe glimmering in the light of that fire, and he talked about the fire of creation. Big Bang, in fact, which is not as weird as you might think, seeing as how Belgian Catholic priest Georges Lemaître came up with the Big Bang Theory. He talked about the energy and intensity of that unimaginable moment so many billions of years ago, how everything erupted across time and space and somehow eventually coalesced, came together, embraced, and became the elements of which we are all made. No wonder fire is so important to us, he said. That's where we come from. And then he lit the 4-foot-tall Easter candle. And from that candle, we all lit our own small candles. And we followed the Easter candle through the dark corridors, no light at all except the flickering candles. And we sang. Outside, it was still pitch black. But during the long and beautiful service that followed, you could feel the brightness, the light slowly gathering, as the light slowly came up in the church. And we celebrated Holy Communion. Sometimes my friends ask me, what kind of religion uses something as ugly as a cross as its primary symbol? The kind of religion that takes suffering and sadness seriously. What kind of religion celebrates something as unlikely as the resurrection? The kind of religion that looks for the light that rises on the other side of sorrow. Well, Mass ended, and we all went outside just as the first sunlight was touching the top of Mount Sopras and turning that silver-white snow into rose and gold, and the sky was rising into a rich, deep blue. It was filling with blue like a chalice, blue as the bluebirds, blue as the hem of Mary's robe in the very old paintings. And Jupiter and the moon were still hovering above the peaks. And right then, the coyotes erupted into what I can only call the Hallelujah Chorus. We always say coyotes howl, but they do so much more than that. And that Easter sunrise, they just skirled insanely across the sky. It was like a cacophonous convention of carnivorous rock and roll bagpipe players. We all stood there, just gobsmacked, laughing, monks and civilians alike. Nobody could have said anything over the coyotes anyway. We just listened to that canine call and response as it went on and on and on. And we looked at each other and looked at the sky, and I did not have room in my body to even hold the joy that was growing inside me. I never did ask the coyotes what they were doing. I assume they were celebrating a communion meal of sorts. I don't want to know the details, but that it was a sacrament, I have no doubt. Maybe not so much for the bunnies, but then again, you never know. In our church that night, we sang, "Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again.
On good days, I rather think that's true of all creation. We all die, we all rise, and we will live again. Another name for that, of course, is spring. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. I know what everyone's thinking. How do they do that? Can I do that? How can I do that? And the answer is, it's not that hard. I think in this day and age, we all are in danger of losing the ability to have a conversation with another person, let alone tell a story to another person. I think it's pretty easy to demonstrate that each of us, it happens every time. We put out a call, we ask, we come up with a theme, and then people just have a story to tell. And it's, they're always just great, and they're just, it's really heartening to hear that. And I think it's a real antidote to kind of what happens to us these days. So I would just encourage you all to, you know, think about these stories, think about your own stories, grab a couple people, get them in a circle, and just practice telling a story. Tell a story and share your experience with people. And I think in doing that, we really, really strengthen our community. But before you do that, let's thank our storytellers from tonight one more time. Big round of applause. Thank you all.
Birds do it, bees do it, even educated fleas do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. In Spain, the best upper sets do it, Lithuanians, and let's do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the Finns. Folks in Siam do it. Think of Siamese twins, some Argentines without means do it. People say in Boston beans do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, let's do it, let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, against their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish do it. Let's do it, let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it, though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if shy, do it. Waiter, bring me shad roe in shallow shoals. English souls, do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls, do it. Let's fall in love. Let's fall in love. Let's.